What happens during a pandemic when a TV meteorologist has to broadcast the weather from his home? The weatherman or weatherwoman may have to share the screen with the family pet. So will the fur fly? I'm David James, and next on 2 Main Street, WFIE Chief Meteorologist Jeff Lyons joins me with his cat Betty, who has become a social media sensation. And Tim Troutman with the National Weather Service joins the conversation as Tim and Jeff share the important cooperation between the Weather Service and the media, and also trace the advancements in forecasting severe weather. 2 Main Street is next, presented by Jeffrey Berger of Berger Wealth Services at Bayard Private Wealth Management. From the WNIN Tri-State Public Media Center in downtown Evansville, I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street. Well, in the not-too-distant past, before radar and satellites, folks used to rely on animals to predict the weather. The Farmer's Almanac provided helpful observations, some more practical than others. Now, before we meet my guests, here are a few of my favorite animal weather proverbs. When rabbits are fat in October and November, expect a long, cold winter, guys. And you can count the time a cricket chirps in 14 seconds, okay? Add 40 to that number, and you have the current temperature in Fahrenheit. All right, we'll have to try that one. In 1883, the U.S. Army Signal Service commissioned a guidebook to predict the weather, longer than the 24-hour period of the meteorologists of that era. Now, it seems the guidebook author, H.H.C. Dunwoody, had a high regard for cats regarding the weather. Here are a few government-approved feline weather theories from the 19th century. When cats sneeze, it's a sign of rain. When cats are snoring, foul weather follows. And cats lick table legs to signal an approaching storm. Okay, so we'll closely be watching the antics of guest number one, Betty the Weather Cat. She's seen frequently on WFIE-TV along with her fellow forecaster, guest number two, Chief Meteorologist Jeff Lyons. And guest number three, Tim Troutman, is here. He's a warning coordination meteorologist with the National Weather Service. So welcome, guys, to 2 Main Street. And Jeff is...
Guest number two out here, David.
Guest number one. Betty, the weather cat's guest number one.
Guest number one is actually in our cat carrier right
now. Oh, hi, Betty.
So she thinks you're the veterinarian. I think
I'm not. Hey, I'm cool. Yeah. I'm cool.
Timothy, you'll do the honor. Just hold that.
I'll hold
just
that.
Sort of peel her out of here.
She's got a stage fright.
Oh, hi, Betty. Okay. It's okay, Betty. Now, have you noticed Betty sneezing or snoring lately?
Always. This cat is not overworking. We got some ice water thanks to Sarah Downs here and your production crew for accommodating the cat. And we'll see if she won't take a little drink here for a minute.
I think she's just kind of checking out the surroundings
here. She's making sure there are no, vets in the neighborhood. So.
Dogs.
Right. Veterinarians, not veterans, vets.
Of course, Betty the Weather Cat's going to be stealing the show here, this whole program. But Tim Troutman, let's get you in here. The government has come a long way, of course, in weather prediction since the animal guidebook in 1883. Not just a 24-hour forecast, of course, with long-range forecasts based on years of data. Is that correct, sir?
That is correct. We can, pretty well forecast the weather, at a very good accuracy, at least out to 7 days. And then we then from there definitely look at normals and definitely the, above or below normal precipitation temperature-wise. So it's really getting to the point to where we could, in the near future, with technology improving, be able to branch out a little further involving that forecast. We really focus in on that first seven days of the forecast. And that's really what's, in most cases, what's important for folks.
Well, sure. I mean, you've got farmers, of course, and school officials and everybody else checking out that seven-day forecast, definitely.
Yeah, and definitely we do the Climate Prediction Center out of Maryland. They definitely put together a seasonal forecast, and that helps a lot of different agencies and organizations and businesses to plan ahead as they're, you know, transportation is a big deal, you know, involving a lot of different freight and things like that that go across the world. And having an idea of the trending over a longer period of time is really important for those industries.
Well, I think the Weather Service was first founded based on commerce in the United States, getting products from here to there safely. So now before we talk about more about Betty the Weather Cat, who's really quite photogenic, I want to learn more about this cooperation, Jeff, between the media and the National Weather Service. How's that going?
Well, we call it the Weather Enterprise, which, you know, you might laugh, but that's actually the term that we use in the Weather Service,
really?
In the media and everything else, because you have several parts, of course. The Weather Service comprised of many, would you say thousands, if not tens of thousands, scientists and physicists, and these are the brightest brains in the country, I mean, almost without exception, who are working research to make the models work better. They're radar technicians and people that design this stuff. I just did a conference for the National Weather Association a couple weeks ago, and hearing these men and women present, it's like, you know, here I'm sitting with a cat talking about the next 3 days. These people are doing the real hard science. But, you know, as with everything, it's highly technical and always evolving, but it has to be communicated to, you know, just the regular guy who just wants to know if it's going to rain or not tomorrow. Yeah. And so that's kind of how the media works into that piece. And of course, we have to be educated too in meteorology, just maybe not at the level that a lot of the National Weather Service is. But our primary job is to communicate and to do it in a way that will hopefully draw people to listen to the message and to heed warnings and things like that. So, yeah, it's in my experience, and of course, you know, I've been at this 35 years, 33 here at WFIE in Evansville. And we've always been blessed with a very strong local office. Originally, of course, it was in Evansville. And then when the Weather Service modernized, kind of streamlined their operations, it moved down the road to Paducah. And we've had uninterrupted, what I would say, excellent service along the way. And quite a few characters, too. Not to say everybody at the Weather Service is a stuffy, dry scientist. There are some fascinating individuals that have worked in the Weather Service and, of course, in broadcasting, too.
So, Tim Trauman, how important is the media to getting the word out?
Oh, the media are absolutely the most important part of what we do. We're pretty much our co-number one partner other than emergency management. And, you know, I kind of call it the warning triad, you know, and I use that in a presentation where the media is just paramount to broadcasting the warnings and getting that vital information, that vital warning information out to the public in the matter of seconds. And having that great working relationship is just awesome and helps us to make sure that we get that warning information out to the public. That's number one. Our average warning lead time is kind of topped out nationally at about 14 minutes. So it's really important for us to work with the media to get that message out as quickly as possible, both preparedness and also during severe weather, and also just really day-to-day forecasting. We closely coordinate with Jeff and other TV meteorologists and TV stations, radio stations, and different folks involving the daily grind of forecasting the weather. We have a chat program known as NWS Chat that we can feed that information to them behind the scenes. So if Jeff is on air going with wall-to-wall coverage, he probably has a little monitor off to the side, and he can look at the chat and say, hey, the National Weather Service in Paducah, they're about to issue a tornado warning, so be prepared in the next few seconds. If you're in this area, you know, be prepared that this tornado warning probably will be coming out, and we'll be giving you more information as it's occurring. So that that just working together gives as much of a heads up as we can give to the public, and that's what it's all about.
And I was amazed. I went down to the Paducah office. I've been there several times, and when you walk in to the what they call the forecast floor, right? So they have all the different forecasters, men and women, down there working. And but up on the wall, it's like a newsroom. They have four or five monitors, and they're watching the coverage coming in from the media. In this case, it would be the Paducah TV stations in Evansville, to make sure that, okay, well, we put a warning out, okay, it's on all three, or you know, wherever it happens to be. I think there's a misconception that somehow we're competitors, you know, the TV station's trying to beat the weather service or vice versa, and that's not true at all. We're working together. We're on the same team. We want everybody to be safe and to heed the warnings, and so you know, it works best when we work together, and we want a unified message. You don't want to have, you know, one station saying, well, there's a tornado warning, and the other one saying, nah, it's not so bad. It's got to be consistent. I mean, we've seen that with other things, you know, in life here recently, misinformation and so forth. And I think the Weather Service, the weather enterprise with the media, is one really shining example of how a unified message has the greatest impact and causes the most, the greatest number should be true and accurate when it goes out.
Now, as weather consumers, we rely on these forecasts based on the latest technology, of course, and the expertise of trained meteorologists. But sometimes Mother Nature does throw us a curveball and surprises everybody. Has that happened before, Tim Troutman?
Well, you know, weather is an inexact science, if that's the buzzword we want to talk about today. And, you know, even though we have the best technology in the world, you know, and in the U.S., here with the National Weather Service, you know, it's still, you know, we're still not to 100% accuracy with any of the technology. So it's, you know, it's the important part of collaborating with the media, finding out what they're thinking about an event, also getting those spotter reports, also, you know, working together with emergency management in the counties, and also just, you know, making sure that we learn from events that we may not do so well on, so the next time we can get better. That's the objective, is to get as close as we can to 100% accuracy. So, you know, just looking at our statistics, we're definitely over about 90-plus percent accurate involving our forecast now, and that's a huge difference
even
from when I started on September 11th, 1989. So it's definitely an improvement.
I started in 86, and you know, at that point, there were models, of course, but, man, it was always a coin toss, you know, and which model to go with and so forth. But now, you know, it's gotten to the point where there are so many models and very good ones and very high resolution. And now the Weather Service is actually using what they call the National Blend of Models. So they take all the models and then they churn those together. And that's why you see these hurricane forecasts that are so uncannily accurate 5 and 6 days out. Not to say it's exact, but it's within, you know, 20, 30 miles. The Ida, when it came into New Orleans or into Louisiana, that was very well forecast several days out. I mean, 4 or 5 days. And, you know, that gives emergency managers and the public time, hopefully, to react. You were talking about unexpected things. So one thing that Ida did and that a lot of hurricanes are doing now is when they get close to the shore, the water's a lot warmer, especially in the Gulf, and they rapidly intensify. So it'll be like a Category 2 out in the open water, and then in a couple days, or not even a couple days, within 12 hours, it could go Category 4, which is very hard to predict.
And we were looking at that, you know, the main key to our forecast models still, and they've been released since the 1930s, are the upper air weather balloons. We released those at over 80 locations across the country. And all that data, when we release the weather balloon, it has a what's called a radiosonde instrument, if you can picture it. It's a little square box. And we turn on the computer within the radiosonde. It's a little small computer. And it emits a signal down to the ground station there, and we collect the data as the balloon moves up into the atmosphere up into about 70,000 feet. So that balloon, it expands and gets probably about the size of a vehicle before it pops. And it usually takes about an hour or so for the balloon to launch and go through the whole process. And we collect the temperature, the dew point temperature, the humidity, the wind speed, direction of the wind, the pressure in the atmosphere. All that data flows back to our office. And the all 80 offices or so that do release the balloons, all that data goes to one big supercomputer in Maryland. Well, this supercomputer has a long math problem inside the computer, which we call a model, which is what we were talking about. And all that data flows through the model, and it spits out forecast weather maps. So you know, we typically look at about, you know, four or five different types of models most of the time, and we know from experience, well, this model usually handles things pretty good with this type of scenario or the first 12 hours of the forecast, which gets into the blended models. Now we've really gone that direction and involving the one-hour forecast that we do all the way out to 7 days now, it definitely has improved, I feel, the accuracy.
If the map looks a certain way today, you can plug that in, and the computer, the system will kick out what we call analog, similar weather events and how they played out. So, like, if I look at the map today and it says, oh, yeah, and the it's unbelievable, the system can, I don't know how far the analogs go back. It's like at least 1950s, 50. Right?
Yeah, okay. About 1950s.
So basically some poor, you know, group had to input all the surface maps that were hand analyzed back then into this system. But essentially what it does is you say, okay, here's what the weather map looks like today. And then the model will say, okay, well, the last four times or five times it looked like this were, you know, 1963, 1948, 1999, and this is what happened. Then you can start with that and see, wow. Okay, well, did the low generate snow in that one? And mm-hmm. that gives you confidence, because like Tim said, you know, if you forecast a long time, you remember these things. But as we all know, you know, our mm-hmm. phone can remember a lot more when you plug stuff in the computer, in That's the right. calendar and so forth. So by looking at the analog, you at least have an idea of, well, how did this play out before? It doesn't right. always work, but it's often close.
It's often pretty close.
History rhymes if it doesn't repeat itself.
Yeah, the St. Louis University, they collected a lot of the severe weather analogs. So we actually, for about 12 or so years now at the Weather Service, we've been using these severe weather analogs in advance of expected severe weather outbreaks to give us an idea. Well, with these type of conditions, the wind speeds moving across the country at this speed, the amount of moisture, the strength of this cold front coming in, what's it going to compare to in the past? And one good example was when I was working as a warning coordination meteorologist at the Morristown, Tennessee office in East Tennessee, we took a look at the analogs around April 27th, 2011, and it compared favorably to the April 3rd, 74 super outbreak, and I hate to say it, verified.
Yeah. That was, of course, the Dixie outbreak or the Deep mm-hmm. South, Deep South. Super outbreak, too.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's interesting, Tim, that you're based in Henderson, Kentucky, but you provide weather forecasts for Wyoming.
Yes.
How does that work?
Well, I've been able to telework with things that have been going on lately with COVID, so it's really been a blessing to be back in the tri-state. I have to put on my Wyoming hat every morning and forecast and help out the office and do what I would normally do administratively from Henderson. So it's been a blessing. You know, I've got some elderly parents too, so it's been really good to be back in the tri-state area. I've been away from here as long as I was here. So
out of my 50, up in this area?
I grew up in Henderson County and really was interested in weather after the April 3rd, 74 outbreak. Unfortunately, that event kind of opened my eyes about tornadoes. And in 1978, the blizzard, and watching Marcia Yockey and old Double L Young, Lloyd Lindsey Young back in those days. Their zany weather and the professor, they all kind of got me interested more in weather. And I wanted to do TV weather, but it just didn't work out that way. It's odd how you meet people, you know, in your life, and they kind of direct you in certain areas. And I ended up meeting someone that I worked with in a summer job, and they introduced me to Norm Carroll, who was the meteorologist in charge of the Evansville National Weather Service office at the time. And we got together, and he met with me, and I was doing a class at Western Kentucky University that I got credit for by volunteering at the Weather Service. I was able to, from there, they had an opening, and I was able to get on at the Weather Service. I had a choice between doing a weekend weather maybe in Bowling Green, Kentucky versus government job, and and I kind of weighed all that, you know, benefits and things like that. So I thought, well, and it was closer to home. So that's why I started out at the Evansville National Weather Service office.
Well, we're going to take a break now, and coming up, my guests will share more of their fascination with the weather. And also Tim Troutman's research into a local weather icon, the late Marcia Yockey. And how did Betty's still here, did Betty enter the life of the Jeff Lyons family? This is 2 Main Street, presented by Jeffrey Berger of Berger Wealth Services at Bayard Private Wealth Management, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. My guests are Tim Troutman, Warning Coordination Meteorologist with the National Weather Service, and WFIE-TV Chief Meteorologist Jeff Lyons. And Jeff has brought along his cat, Betty, who has become a viewer favorite, making frequent appearances during Jeff's weather forecast. So, Jeff, before Betty, there was an animated weather dog. Right?
Well, that's right. And I should point out that the only reason that Betty is here today is because you wanted her here. And you're a critter guy. I love
critters.
Animal stories on the news.
Well, tell us about Scuffy.
Yes, let's. So when we were working together, you know, way back, we had a computer system at work that was intended to do the weather maps and everything. But you could draw cartoons on it if you wanted. And I don't really remember how or why it started, but you typically would end the newscast with kind of a funny story, the kicker, yes. And oftentimes you kind of lean toward an animal story. You know, the water skiing squirrel would be the classic example, but we've had many
still
others.
Still is the classic
right, yeah,
example.
Exactly. And so anyway, I drew this dog, and I named it Scuffy. We used to have neighbors had a dog named Scuffy when I was a kid. And always go through the trash, our trash.
Not Scruffy.
No, not Scruffy. Scuffy, S-C-U-F-F-Y. So anyway, I drew this dog, and then Scuffy would get into different, you know, situations, and they didn't end well. Oftentimes, it was very unflattering for the TV station that we worked at.
I remember those.
But nobody seemed to notice, so it was like it just empowered me, and you egged me on, and I would just, you know, draw these things. I had a picture of the TV station and kind of this, you know, sewage pipe coming out into a lake and Scuffy swimming around in it, and you noticed. Of course, you would just chuckle. And anyway, we were getting away with that, and you know.
Well, didn't Scuffy turn into like a skeleton within the lake?
Scuffy did many things, part of organized crime and whatnot. Usually, it was tied into whatever the story was that you ended with. Well, anyway, then fast forward to the pandemic, and I'm doing the weather in my dining room with a chroma key screen and computers and everything, and. We were in a break before we went on, and Betty here climbed up on the dining room table because there were lights on. She thought there was food, probably. And I picked her up, and so the director said, oh, a cat. Put the cat on. I said, no. I said, if we put the cat on, then, you know, we have to always put the cat on. Oh, come on, please, you know, okay. So I put the cat on. Well, then, and I posted a picture of it. I said, well, Betty. And I christened her Betty the Weather Cat. I thought, well, that's not very original, but, you know, we'll see what happens.
Well, how'd she get the name Betty?
She named after my Aunt Betty, who was a real character, lived in Terre Haute when I worked my first job there. And Aunt Betty, we could do a whole 2 Main Street on Aunt Betty, but we don't have time or resources. But anyway, I posted this picture of me holding Betty in front of the weather map, and the darn thing went viral. And like 2 days later, it was on the Today Show. And of course, I didn't see any of this stuff. And then my daughter's calling from IU saying, she was home, actually. Nobody was anywhere. And then it just took off. And we did an interview with the New York Times and you know, all these animal reporters came out of the woodwork, you know, doing stories on Betty the Weather Cat. RT, the Russian Times, even wanted an interview. I didn't grant them an interview. They were the only one I stiffed because I thought, I don't know about this.
And you know, we got some watch list.
The magazine Catster called up.
Catster.
You don't subscribe?
No, I haven't heard of that one.
No, I hadn't either, but they were wonderful people to talk to. The funny thing was all the reporters who were assigned the cat beat would tell me their cat story. Oh, I have a cat named Myrtle, and Myrtle loves to sit in the sun, you know, and I'm thinking, well, that's great, but I got to, like, move along here, you know. And so and we did Skype interviews with Betty, and then I'd put her on the weather every night, you know, at 10 o'clock. And she'd do, she had, like, a little throne I built over there for her so she could sit and watch me do the weather. And people just seem to like it for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. So now she's pretty much just on my social media on Facebook. Mm-hmm. And but she does have a following. There were people from all continents, all around the world that follow Betty. Mm-hmm. And my daughter, seeing dollar signs, because it's her cat, you know, she's like, how can we monetize this? And I said, look, I said, you know, I can't get into the cat making money business. I'm already a commercial broadcaster. So she started an Instagram account for Betty. Betty has 11,000 followers.
Betty.
And so my daughter Natalie writes it in the person of Betty. So like it would be, what was Betty thinking? You know, so the little captions will say, you know, dad's coming in with tuna for me. I hope he's not late. You know, that kind of stuff. And, you know, but my daughter has taken a zillion pictures of me with this cat that I didn't know about. And they show up, you know, going all over. I'm like, you know, am I shorts coming out of the shower, and, you know, it's like you really need to use some discretion. So, but it's been a fun adventure.
Oh, and, yeah. Well, know, we really enjoy
unforeseen
Betty's presence here. So, I think she wants to get down and roam a little bit.
Well, I hate to take away from the gravity of this interview with a cat, you know, hanging
well,
out
I knew we were going to be upstaged by the cat anyway. That's a given.
That so, a, no, question.
So, Tim, anything that gets people involved in the weather, you're gung-ho for that,
I'm
right?
I'm all for it, you know, and that's what we want. We want folks to keep abreast of the weather and keep a close watch to the weather as we're getting toward that fall season time period now. And
yeah, we're getting into cool season, severe weather.
Oh, yeah. Tornadoes and we have those winter tornadoes, which are, boy, those are nasty.
Yeah, November 6, of course, is the big one that everybody remembers. And that was, in many ways, surprising. I mean, we knew the atmosphere was set up for thunderstorms and maybe a couple severe and then a tornado possible, but no one could have foreseen what actually turned up.
No, a strong EF3, 41-mile track, you know, unfortunately, 24 deaths, 238 injuries. You know, it's very unfortunate. But just a testament, you know, we worked closely with the media to get the warnings out and had really good warning lead times. It was just that time of the morning.
We were hobbled. Yeah, 2 o'clock in the morning, you don't have a lot of people at that time who had weather radios that would wake them up. Phone apps really hadn't developed where they would alert you in the same way that we think of now. And ironically, it was one of 2 tornadoes, I think, in the country on that particular event. The one, of course, that went through the southeast Vandenberg County in Newburgh. Sure. There was another one in Webster or...
The Henderson-Webster
Yeah, it was right there south, mm-hmm. but it went through a rural area, so there was very low impact. And, if this tornado had even shifted 2 or 3 miles south, it would have just been, some trees down and maybe a few injuries. But the fact that it hit a mobile home community was devastating.
Now, I know when there's a tornado warning, when I was working at Channel 14, you would stay on the air until that warning expired.
Right, mm-hmm. And hopefully you were on a little bit before, leading up to...
Well, usually it's a tornado watch, and then it becomes a warning. You're prepared as you watch it move across the map.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So is that an established policy for all television stations, then, to stay on the air?
No.
I can let maybe you speak to that one, but...
I didn't know if you had any guidance from the Weather Service on that, or is that just up to the station?
Yeah, it's really up to the TV station, mm-hmm. but, the important thing that folks need to further understand is a tornado watch means conditions are favorable for severe weather, including definitely tornadoes, in the next maybe 3 to 6 hours within that watch area. A watch means get ready and get set, means keep a closer watch to the weather. And then when we are in the tornado watch, you know, at the Weather Service, we're bringing in extra people into the operations area, getting ready for the event, calling up the storm spotters, activating the spotter network, getting on chat, really starting to collaborate more about, well, we're expecting the storms to erupt during this time period, you know, and then as the storms are taking off and beginning to occur, then we're trying to give updates to the media on NWS chat and also, you know, via social media. And then, of course, when the warning is issued, that means go to your safe place. Have a predetermined safe place. That's what I can definitely tell everyone right now. Go to the Weather Service website, you know, local media, Red Cross. There's a lot of good information on those websites involving where to go, what to do. You know, obviously in your home, the best place to move to is if you have a basement. That's obviously the best place. If you don't have a basement, move to your most interior area of your home. You want as many walls between you and the high winds as possible. You know, a hallway, a bathroom, cover your head. Most injuries are head-related due to flying debris. And, you know, if you're driving, as a lot of us are in the, you know, the main part of the afternoon, getting off of work and however, because in a lot of cases our, you know, tornadoes occur during the time of the, you know, heated part of the day, you know, usually that 4 to 5 p.m., 6 p.m. time period. So, you know, if you're driving along, a tornado warning is issued or a tornado is spotted, I'd like to challenge everyone right now, find 3 or 4 or 5 locations along your normal route home to get off the road at a moment's notice. Look for it now, and not when the event is occurring. If you see a tornado, you know, get off that road and move to a more sturdy building and try to ride it out at that point, because you're already in a bad spot.
When I was very new at Channel 14 in 1990, June the 2nd, we had a major tornado that came across, a series of them actually, that came across Illinois. This is a Petersburg tornado, and yes. Mount Carmel and Albion and Browns.
I was there.
Yeah, you were there. You were running the radar in the forecast office. It was the biggest outbreak in Indiana since 1974, I would imagine. Yeah,
It sure was.
34, 35 tornadoes statewide.
Yes.
But long track tornado. And we only did cut-ins. I broke in, you know, it's a Saturday night, and, you know, you would say, well, there's a tornado moving in. And we had the radar and everything. And then, you know, you'd kind of say your piece, and then we now join Punky Brewster in progress. And then they'd go back. And the cut-ins got longer and longer. It was like ridiculous. Plus, nobody could follow the plot line on Blossom, you know, if we blacked out 28 minutes of it. So finally, we just kind of evolved into that, well, you know, do they want to see, you know, an entertainment show, or do they want to see the weather? And 9 times out of 10, they want to see the weather. Now, don't ask me that question if the Indianapolis 500, the Kentucky Derby's on, you know, the Game 7 of the NBA or whatever, or the Voice. We do get a lot of pushback from people who are not affected, you know, because remember, we cover 100 miles top to bottom, east to west, and we can have, you know, a major weather event going on, let's say in Pike County, Petersburg or Princeton in Gibson County, and the sun shining in Owensboro, and, you know, those people want to watch whatever was scheduled, and, you know, we have to say we have to be here for all the viewers, and usually I find cooler heads prevail, so I never answer those emails day of, because they can be vicious. And you wait a day or two, and then you just write back and say, hey, thanks. Yeah, I understand your frustration, but we got to do what we got to do. And they'll say, well, I was just mad at that time.
Well, once they see the damage from a storm, the next day they realize, hey, this was really serious. This should have been my hometown.
Yeah,
that's right. That June the 2nd outbreak, that was the first tornado outbreak I worked in the Weather Service. And it was really just organized chaos because we had about 6 people in the office, Ernie Block, Sylvia, Niemeyer, myself, Kelly Hooper, there were about 2 or 3 others. Norm Carroll, my boss, was there, and you know, the thing that I do remember vividly was we were tracking a storm that was moving along the Ohio River, and it moved right into right along Highway 41. And of course, it was time for me to go out. We took a surface weather observation every hour on routine. I walk out there, and I'm looking over Whirlpool, and there is a large funnel cloud just taking shape about 200 feet off the ground. And of course, I'm all excited and just a little scared too,
because
I'm thinking this could touch down any moment. It was huge. So I'm running back into the office, and when you see something like that with taking a surface weather observation, you have to issue what's called an urgent special for the aviation interests, and so that they'll know. And we're already using the computer to issue warnings, and we're cranking out warnings left and right. So I have to go directly to the other computer to type up the urgent special funnel cloud 1 mile south. Well, I was excited, and the weather in me took over, and I hit funnel cloudy and enter, and I'm like, no, I need to bring it
but
back.
It went. Yeah,
I had to send a correction. That was my big chance, and I blew it.
So you know, you weren't there for the Allendale tornado. That was January 7th, 89.
I was unofficially there. I was volunteering at the time.
Oh,
so
my.
I wasn't on the official clock.
And that was Saturday.
And that occurred probably around 4 p.m.-ish in the afternoon.
Saturday
it was
afternoon.
On a Saturday. I remember that.
And
that
in my
was,
case,
it was an unfortunate event.
The entire station, not the entire station, but we'll say the A and B players, were at the chief meteorologist's wedding. Kevin Janison, Kevin D, was getting married down at the old courthouse.
Yeah.
And I'm sure he woke up that morning and thought, oh, you know, surely not. And so they were all down there, and it was, I had been there a month, and just happened to come by the TV station that afternoon. I had a buddy in town. I said, oh, yeah, you want to look around? We walked in that radar. Of course, back then, you didn't, if you weren't at work, you really couldn't follow the weather.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, that shouldn't look like that. And I said, well, I better go home and get a suit, you know, and went home and came back. And by that point, we were looking at the Allendale tornado, which was
a four.
Yeah, it was very strong. And destroyed about a third of Allendale in January.
Unfortunately,
you know,
killed several people.
Yeah, it did. And that was kind of my baptism by fire, you know. And I thought, boy, this is the real deal. I got to be on my game all the time.
The difference in the technology then to now is just incredible. I mean, we were operating a WSR 57 radar with the old vacuum tubes from the early 1950s, and it was really, there was no color, it was black and white, and we just looked at reflectivity, which is a measure of the moisture in the clouds, versus it did not have a Doppler component to it, so we couldn't look into the storm and see the direction of the winds and the rotation of the winds that would be producing.
Yeah.
And so it, you know, we had to look for the old-fashioned, as we call them, the hook echo,
where the
tornado was forming, you know, and those type of events, if you had rain in and around the radar, those old 57 radars, it would attenuate the beam, which means it would bend the beam, the precipitation, into the ground somewhat. So it would kind of blank out the radar. It was just an unfortunate
it was part of the radar, though. Of course, I'm a history guy. That room, I can remember the smell because it had all these vacuum tubes and enamel, you know, kind of that green, government green console. And it looked like a front-load washing machine. Like it had a glass screen. And, you know, of course, the thing went around.
I kept waiting for it to grab me someday.
And the forecasters would take a piece of plastic, acetate, right, that was gridded. And they would that fit into the circle, and they'd put it on. Then they'd take a wax pencil and trace out where the rain was or whatever, and then take that out. And then that
sounds so archaic.
Oh, yeah.
I haven't done that since 1994. I guarantee I could take an observation still. I did it so many times.
It's
almost like a robot.
It was like something out of like a Frankenstein movie. So they would stop the radar. The radar works basically, that radar worked in two modes. It either went around or it could go up and down.
Yes.
So if they saw a thunderstorm and they want to know how tall it was, they did what's called an RHI, or range height indicator. And so they would stop the radar. They had this crank thing, and they like,
you could crank it up.
And kind of a,
you know, this little display.
This meter and, you know, oscilloscopes going. And, you know, the only thing it didn't have was like the two big things with the, you know, the lightning bolt between them. Yeah.
And, you know, the best way to clean off the grease pencils was ash from an ashtray.
Oh, that's right.
I'm not kidding and there was plenty of smoking in there too. But I didn't smoke. But
Oh, Betty's trying to escape here. We'll have to. We have our people here. They're doing some.
Sarah Downs is out there. She
Sarah's
wants some FaceTime with
Betty. Well, my guests are Chief Meteorologist at WFIE-TV, Jeff Lyons, and Tim Trowin with the National Weather Service. Now, we can't forget about Marcia Yockey. Now, coming up, we're going to talk about Marcia's years with the National Weather Service, her years on TV. I know Tim's been doing some research on Marcia for the National Weather Service. I'm anxious to find out what you found about Marcia and the reaction to her. I'm David James. This is 2 Main Street, presented by Jeffrey Berger of Berger Wealth Services at Bayard Private Wealth Management. We're going to round up Betty, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. If you are just joining us, we're talking weather with Tim Trautman of the National Weather Service and WFIE-TV Chief Meteorologist Jeff Lyons, who has brought along Betty the Weather Cat, his muse during the pandemic, and still bringing smiles to the viewers. And she has internet stardom as well, this furry feline, Betty. Now, of course, Betty is stealing the show as usual. The National Weather Service dates back to 1870 when President Ulysses Grant signed into law the creation of a new National Weather Service within the U.S. Army Signal Service. Weather data, of course, had been collected via telegraph from weather observers around the country. And even Thomas Jefferson recorded the temperature. He got a thermometer, I understand. He recorded the temperature on Independence Day, July 4th, 1776, and the high temperature, of course, was 76 degrees, of course.
What else?
Why not? Of course, George Washington was an avid weather observer. He kept a diary, and I think his last weather observation was the day before he died.
Yes,
and Benjamin Franklin also.
Oh, Benjamin Franklin.
Into that.
James Madison also.
I read a book. It was called The Storm Kings, I believe. And it had to do with, in that period, the first tornado chasers. Of course, they didn't know what it was in the 1700s, and they called it a whirl. And these guys were on horseback tracing a storm and reporting back. And I want to say, and correct me if I'm wrong, and I probably am, but I thought that Benjamin Franklin may have tried to do what we call a surface analysis, where you would get weather information from several points, and then you plot it. So you connect like temperatures and pressures. So when you get the finished map, if you have enough observation points, you get the isobars and kind of like what Marcia used to draw, but it would have been very rudimentary. And of course, these observations were sent by horseback and carrier pigeon and smoke signals, so it wasn't real immediate, but they were able to forecast, backcast, because they had to look at it and say, oh, well, that's why it rained, because we had this, that, and the other going on.
Of course, they were 100% right. They could postcast.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, postcast. That's the word I'm looking for.
I like it.
But people will still ask today, why I don't draw the isobars like Marcia used to. And I said, well, they're on there. I said, I don't use a magic marker. And, but her maps were really a work of art. I mean, she would transcribe or copy the surface map. And if you were just looking at it, if you're a weather person, you look at it, you're like, wow, she got away with that on TV? Because, the people, consultants and management, they're terrified of any kind of, anything other than pretty color. Yeah. So,
well, that leads us into Tim Trautman's research into the local weather icon, the late Marcia Yockey. She worked for the National Weather Service before beginning her TV weather career at both WTVW and WFIE in Evansville. So, Tim, you've been, talking to a lot of folks, and what have you learned about those early years in your project?
Well, she was basically attending college at the University of Evansville, studying to be a chemist, and she evidently saw there was an advertisement in the newspaper that the U.S. Weather Bureau is seeking female observers. And it was during World War II. So there, during that time period, a lot of the federal workers were either transferred within the Weather Bureau to Washington, D.C., different other areas, Europe, Pacific, And, you know, they needed people. So the Weather Bureau, you know, put that notice out. Marcia applied, was hired. She completed her weather training in Chicago. And then from there, that was in sometime between the fall and early fall of 1943 to early 1944. And then that was about a 6-month training class, and she made it back and worked at the Evansville office here at the very close to where the old National Weather Service office was at Dress Regional Airport, just within less than a half a mile from there. And at that time, the Weather Bureau had two offices. They had an office downtown on Vine and at the post office there, and also the little observer's location there at the airport. And she worked there until they consolidated the office about 1950. And then at that point, she made it past World War II time frame when all the you know, the soldiers and the displaced Weather Bureau employees came back. They kept her, and she and another lady worked there until the early 50s. And in 1952, she was transferred out to the Weather Bureau office in Grand Island, Nebraska. And then at that point, you know, she got her pilot's license and wanted to obviously come back home, because she was from here in Evansville, and she would fly back frequently with, of course, without instrument flight rules and all that good stuff. She was a daredevil, I tell you.
I've flown with her. I can tell stories about that.
Water towers, you know,
navigate by water towers.
And I may have this a little bit wrong, but I'm going to try to give you the best that I can to get her toward the transition to TV. Evidently, the family or someone, somehow she connected with a congressman or something like that.
Ed Mitchell.
And then he let her know that there was going to be an opening, and they were opening WFIE-TV. And from there, she transitioned out of the Weather Bureau to doing TV weather. The reason I really like this project, too, is even though she moved over to TV and she was in the media from then on, she always remembered her roots back to the Weather Bureau. And she would, you know, she would come out to the – I was told, and I interviewed Ernie Block, who's still living. I interviewed Sylvia Niemeyer also about Marcia and the project. And, of course, you, mm-hmm. David, and others. And haven't got to you, Jeff, yet. But anyhow,
I've given you a lot of information, old film clips and stuff. So,
been very, very much appreciated. And, you know, she would come out to the Weather Service office every evening for years and years. And sometimes I was told she would spend as many as two or three hours out there just poring over the weather maps, asking the meteorologist at the Weather Service, well, what do you think about this? And this is what I'm thinking. And they would kind of work together to put together the best forecast that they could find and put together for the area. And, you know, and from what you had told me and others had told me, she would stay out there a lot of times till about 9:45 and then rush to the TV station and get there just in time to get her map done. And, you know, and when she was out there at the Weather Bureau or Weather Service office, she had a smaller map that she would take with her, and she would annotate all that information, then bring it back and put it on the big map on the board. And just having that close working relationship with the Weather Service, I think, was important to her success, because we were basically providing the official forecast, and she helped us too, because she had quite a bit of knowledge working 10 years in the Weather Bureau too,
and being a pilot.
She loved what she did.
Mm-hmm. So what are you doing with this information?
Okay, as part of the National Weather Service's Heritage Program, that's what kind of tuned me into Marcia, because somewhere in the back of my mind I remembered that she had worked for the Weather Bureau, and I thought, you know, this would be a great local project to do to kind of highlight that part of her career that, you know, even though we've talked about it a little bit, there's a lot more to it that I found as I've been going through this. And it'll probably be about a about 15, 20 minutes of a documentary. And I'm going to put that together through the next 3 or 4 weeks now that I've got some other projects out of the way. And by mid-October, it should be finished. And I look forward to unveiling it and so that everyone can learn a little bit more about the Yak.
You know, she was just so unique, and I know that's a cliche.
Well, what's the classic line you still hear?
Marcia knew her weather. No matter what, you know, what I'll ever do in 35 years. I've been on longer than she was, but it doesn't matter. You never get out of that shadow, which is fine, but they'll say, well, you know, especially if you miss a forecast, you know, well, Marcia didn't have that problem. She only had a magic marker, and Marcia knew her weather. She knew her weather.
I think the theme that I've gathered by doing this documentary is the entertainment part of it, and she gave you a good forecast to the best of her judgment.
Yeah, she slipped that forecast in there.
Well, she knew her weather. And she was always at things, you know, like they would – they'd have an event at Washington Square Mall, and she'd be like the Grand Marshal. She used to go to the Wendell Foster Center every Valentine's Day in Owensboro.
Very selfless person.
Disabled individuals over there. And so she had a lot of causes that were close, and she was a good person, you know, and that just came through.
That's further come through in the documentary, too, how selfless and caring and she would just if anyone asked her to do something, she'd do it, you know, and that's just how she was. It was really a blessing to hear all that.
Self-aware, but she I don't think she was in it to promote herself or her, you know, quote unquote brand, to use a current term. She would have blanched it. You say, oh, what's the Marcia brand? but she was, you know, of all the people that have worked in broadcasting in the Evansville market, she's always going to be on the top as the person who really kind of struck a tone, and you know, one word, you know who it is, you know.
Alrighty.
Alrighty. Tim wanted an alrighty clip of her just saying alrighty, because she said that every time she started. Well, I thought she said it every time she started.
I found it.
Oh, good.
4th of July, 1984. And she was dressed up in a one-piece bathing suit with a bow tie when she said that. That's going to be in there.
Okay, good. Yeah, she always used to jump in the river or a lake on the 4th of July, which I think she wanted to do the year she retired. I think they finally said, maybe not this year, and then she decided she was done.
That's another story.
That is.
Hey, guys, this has been a real treat for me, and I know for our listeners and viewers. My guests have been Tim Troutman, the Warning Coordination Meteorologist with the National Weather Service, and Jeff Lyons, Chief Meteorologist at WFIE-TV, and his famous feline, Betty the Weather Cat, who is somewhere under the table probably right now, but she has been very well behaved.
Well, she has. She's right down here.
Betty, thank you very much for being on the show. I'm David.
Okay.
There's Betty. I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street, presented by Jeffrey Berger of Berger Wealth Services at Bayard Private Wealth Management. For information to become a trained weather spotter, go to the National Weather Service website to find out about upcoming spotter training sessions.